Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I am the creative and multimedia editor for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with one of the authors of an original research article and the author of an accompanying editorial that appear in the April 2023 issue. With us today is Dr. Philip Payton. Dr. Payton is the head of anesthesia research and a professor of critical care at Austin Hospital and the University of Melbourne in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Payton is one of the authors on an article that appears in the 2023 issue, the April 2023 issue of the journal, and it's titled Postoperative Pulmonary Complications in the Enigma 2 Trial, a Post Hoc Analysis. Dr. Payton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jim. Nice to be here.
Also with us today is Dr. Marcelo Gama de Abreu. Dr. Abreu is the director of research and a professor of anesthesiology in the Department of Intensive Care and Resuscitation and the Department of Outcomes Research at Cleveland Clinic and Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Abreu co-authored an editorial that accompanied Dr. Payton's original research article, also in the April 2023 issue, and it's titled Nitrous Oxide and Postoperative Pulmonary Complications, Conflicting Evidence. Dr. Abreu, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Dr. Rathmel, Dr. Payton, and listeners of this podcast. It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Dr. Payton, congratulations on the publication of your study. Let's start with a little background. Nitrous oxide promotes absorption atelectasis in poorly ventilated lung segments at high inspired oxygen concentrations. There have now been two large trials, the evaluation of nitrous oxide in the gas mixture for anesthesia or the Enigma trials. Can you tell us what we learned from these earlier trials?
It's a bit of a complicated story, so I'm going to try and go through it sort of chronologically and hopefully distill out the essential elements. Enigma and later Enigma 2 were both investigating the safety of nitrous oxide in major surgery. Both trials were led by my colleague here in Melbourne, Paul Miles. We were intrigued by the preclinical science behind nitrous oxide, its known inhibition of the methionine synthetase enzyme system with consequent elevation of plasma homocysteine levels and interference with DNA synthesis, and the potential that might arise from all this basic science for clinically important outcomes such as immunosuppression and potentially increased cardiovascular complications. In addition, we know it also promotes absorption atelectasis in lung segments with low ventilation perfusion or low VQ ratios. So Enigma, which was it's over 2,000 patients, studied a broad range of major non-thoracic surgery in an adult population. Now, at the time, this is over 15 years ago now, there was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of it coming out of actually from the outcomes research group at Cleveland Clinic that Dr. Dabros is now heading, for high FiO2s as an independent strategy to reduce complications such as wound infection. So the comparator group in Enigma, the non-nitrous group that we chose, was an FiO2 of 80% in air. And the study group was 60-70% nitrous oxide in oxygen. And indeed, Enigma 1 went on to find a lower incidence of postoperative lung atelectasis in the group which didn't receive nitrous oxide, as well as less postoperative nausea and vomiting, as well as possibly reduced pneumonia, sepsis, and wound infections. So this seemed quite compelling evidence for this thesis that nitrous oxide had an underlying toxicity which we needed to identify. Now, Enigma wasn't powered to demonstrate adverse cardiovascular outcomes because the incidence rates of those were lower than the other outcomes we were studying. So that was the driver to Enigma 2, a much larger trial, over 7,000 patients in Enigma 2, which selected an older population with an elevated cardiovascular risk factors and studying the incidence of myocardial infarction and other cardiovascular complications as the primary outcome. Now, In response to some criticism about the different FiO2 in the two groups in Enigma, we deliberately chose to make the FiO2 the same in the two groups in Enigma 2. So both groups received an FiO2 of 30%, one with nitrous and one without nitrous oxide. And we also collected data on wound infection and sepsis in Enigma 2 as well. And in fact, Enigma 2 was certainly an enigma because it went on to find no difference in the primary trial outcome of cardiovascular complications, but there was also no evidence of any difference in wound infection or sepsis rates either, quite contradictory to Enigma. This was a surprise, and I can still recall to my dismay when I realised that we had not collected any data on postoperative lung complications in Enigma 2 because we thought we knew the answer from Enigma. And I remember thinking, gosh, if Enigma 2 hasn't confirmed any of the other findings of Enigma, apart from nausea and vomiting, then what should we be expecting about lung complications in this Enigma 2 population? We haven't collected the data. And this continued to nag at me for years, this gap in our knowledge, which we'd created or allowed to happen, partly driven by my parallel interests in lung gas exchange physiology, in particular the physiology of nitrous oxide. So that was the driver for this particular study.
So the study we're talking about today is a post-hoc analysis of the data from the Enigma 2 trial and other data that was collected after the trial concluded. Can you tell us the hypothesis of your study and how it was carried out?
So the aim here was to try and fill this gap that we'd left behind. It occurred to me sort of rather belatedly that we could effectively replicate the protocol from Enigma on collection of data on pulmonary complications post-hoc, that this would not be a problem because in Enigma, the diagnosis of atelectasis and pneumonia was made in a very pragmatic fashion. It was basically data collected on the basis of a post-operative chest x-ray ordered by the treating surgical unit who were blinded to the treatment allocation, simply in response to clinical indication, as we would do in normal clinical practice. So, in fact, the data that we needed was actually undoubtedly sitting there in the patient's electronic medical records waiting to be found. The null hypothesis of this current postdoc study was that we would find, similar to the findings on sepsis and wound infection in Enigma 2, that there was no difference in the incidence of atelectasis between the two groups. We had limited resources for this study, but we were confident that we could obtain sufficient study power from studying all the Australian hospitals who had participated in Enigma 2 under our single ethics review process, our national process, and that we'd be able to get data from probably about at least 2,500 patients or about 30% of the total international Enigma 2 trial recruitment numbers. So it would be a bit larger than Enigma and that the data would therefore be of use to us. Now, based on the incidence rates we encountered in Enigma on atelectasis and pneumonia, we calculated we would have sufficient study power from this patient sample to demonstrate a 25% relative difference in atelectasis between the two groups in Enigma 2. We deliberately made atelectasis, which we expected to find in about 1 in 5 patients, our primary endpoint because we knew that we wouldn't have sufficient power to study pneumonia as the primary endpoint given its much lower incidence. And look, essentially data at each site was collected by a local site investigator who remained blinded to treatment allocation during data extraction. They first interrogated digitised post-operative radiology records for that index hospital admission during the trial. And where a positive chest x-ray report was found, they then hunted down haematology and microbiology records to meet the other criteria for the definition that was employed, which is the same definition as was used in Enigma. And in the end, we had complete data from over 2,300 patients who had been recruited to Enigma 2, which was suitable for inclusion.
So the primary input was the incidence of atelectasis, and you defined that as lung atelectasis or collapse reported on chest radiography. Pneumonia as a secondary endpoint required a diagnostic chest x-ray report with fever, leukocytosis, or positive sputum culture. What did you find?
That's correct. So what we found was, once again, quite unexpected. The incidence of atelectasis was not greater in the nitrous oxide group as it was in Enigma. In fact, it was almost 20% lower with nitrous oxide, and this difference was statistically significant. The incidence of pneumonia, which is overall about 5%, was not significantly different, nor was that of our combined endpoint, which is a combination of atelectasis and pneumonia.
So what did you conclude from this particular study?
I have to admit that I was scratching my head to try and explain this finding. The only clear difference between the two trial groups in Enigma 2 that we've studied was that there was a lower end-tidal volatile agent concentration in the group receiving nitrous oxide, about a third of a mac lower, which was entirely expected given the max-bearing effects of nitrous oxide, and very similar to what was found in Enigma. But this modest difference didn't seem likely to me to explain such a large clinical effect on atelectasis formation. And in the end, I suspect the answer may lie in considering the emergence phase of anaesthesia, when patients in both arms of the trial routinely receive 100% oxygen prior to extubation. Now, we understand from what we know of the physiology of oxygen breathing that it can very rapidly induce absorption atelectasis in these low ventilation, these low VQ ratio lung regions. However, during these critical minutes, patients who have received nitrous oxide are also rapidly excreting it in large volumes. You've got probably 30 or 40 litres of nitrous oxide on board containing your body tissues by the end of a nitrous oxide anaesthetic. And this is being driven out of these same low VQ lung units as you're emerging. So perhaps this actively prevents or even reverses some of this oxygen-driven absorption atelectasis at this point. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer. It raises for me the question is in fact the common practice of a routine 100% oxygen breathing during emergence an overlooked contributor to the incidence of PPCs? We don't have any large trial evidence to answer that question yet, but it's a tantalising thought to me to try and explain this finding in this postdoc study.
What do you think the primary limitations of this study were?
Well, clearly it would have been better to have collected this data prospectively at the time of the Enigma 2 trial. Although there's no obvious reason to think that the data would have looked any different had we done that to what we've collected post hoc here, because it was collected effectively in exactly the same way. However, we could have had data from 7,000 patients instead of just the 2,300 patients from Australia that we have been able to access, which would have been a more robust finding. Also, there's been a lot of multi-centre trial work in the last decade or more looking at the impact of various ventilation strategies to reduce the risk of pulmonary complications postoperatively. A lot of it led by Dr. Dabrow and his colleagues in Europe. Now, because Enigma 2 was a trial designed to focus on cardiovascular outcomes, we didn't collect any data or very little data on ventilatory settings which could potentially impact pulmonary outcomes. Look, while it seems unlikely there'd be a systematic difference between the two treatment groups in the trial in any of these parameters, it would have been nice to have had that data prospectively collected, at least to be able to demonstrate that there were no other confounding factors to explain this finding.
Dr. Abreu, you authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Payton's research article, and it's in the April 2023 issue of the journal titled Nitrous Oxide and Postoperative Pulmonary Complications, Conflicting Evidence. You do a terrific job of putting Dr. Payton's article and the two Enigma studies into perspective. Please review for us the findings of the two Enigma trials one more time and this new postdoc analysis and explain how the findings are at odds with one another, just to clarify what Dr. Payton just told us.
Sure. In the Enigma 1 study, avoidance of nitrous oxide and simultaneous increase of inspired oxygen concentration during general anesthesia for non-cardiac surgery did not significantly affect the duration of hospital stay, but it did reduce major postoperative complications, including pneumonia, pneumothorax, pulmonary embolism, surgical site infection, myocard infarction, venous thromboembolism, stroke, awareness, and death within 30 days of surgery were reduced as well. Also, less patients presented with severe nausea and vomiting. Patients who were admitted to ICU were more likely to be discharged on any given day if they had not received intraoperative nitrous oxide. In the Enigma 2 study, the use of nitrous oxide in patients with non or suspect coronary artery disease having major non-cardiac surgery did not increase the risk of cardiovascular complications or death. Also, the nitrous oxide agent did not increase the risk of surgical site infection or the risk of developing sepsis. As in the Enigma 1 trial, nitrous oxide increased the risk of postoperative nausea and vomiting in the Enigma 2 trial. The present study from Dr. Payton and his colleagues is a post-hoc analysis of postoperative pulmonary complications in patients who participated in the Australian cohort of the Enigma 2 trial only. The incidence of postoperative atelectasis was significantly lower in patients randomized to nitrous oxide-based anesthesia than those assigned to nitrous oxide-free anesthesia group. But the incidence of pneumonia was comparable between groups. I would say basically these are the opposite effects that were shown in the Enigma 1 trial, especially regarding atelectasis.
Okay, so the obvious question is, why were opposite effects of nitrous oxide on atelectasis seen in the Enigma 1 and the Enigma 2 trials? Now, you tell us in your editorial there are three major considerations to consider. Can you walk us through those three considerations and tell us what you conclude about each possible explanation?
Before doing that, I take the opportunity to congratulate Dr. Payton and his team for putting so much effort into the data collection. I know it's not easy. Conducting this very elegant analysis and reporting those results of the Enigma 2 trial. So the authors really did a fantastic job. But now, coming back to your question, Dr. Rathmel, an explanation for the opposite effects of nitrous oxide on atelectasis in Enigma 1 and 2 trials is not that trivial. And I would like to explore two aspects first. The first one is that detection of atelectasis might have played a role. The reported overall incidence of atelectasis in Enigma 1 and Enigma 2 was only about 13%. We had an investigation in our group using magnetic resonance imaging. It's a very sensitive method that revealed that the incidence of atelectasis after major abdominal surgery is something about 60%. Depending on the threshold that we use for the cutoff in the MRI study, more than two-thirds of patients had atelectasis on the first postoperative day. Dr. Payton's group used computed tomography imaging, which is also sensitive, but also chest X-ray, which is not that sensitive, I would say, for the detection of atelectasis. Also, I would say lung imaging was not conducted in all patients, as I could understand from the manuscript, which might be prone to, let's say, non-intentional selection bias. However, I am still convinced that even if atelectasis was not detected in all patients who did have atelectasis, this likely applies to both groups. The second aspect that I would like to address is that the effects of nitrous oxide and nitrogen on formation of atelectasis. It's known that nitrous oxide has higher solubility, and for that reason, it promotes absorption atelectasis in lung segments with low ventilation perfusion ratios, as Dr. Payton already mentioned. And this occurs more rapidly than nitrogen, but this is true for steady state conditions only. We must consider, however, the whole period, so it's not only the steady state. For example, the change in concentrations that we have during induction and also during emergence from anesthesia. And here we really have an interesting issue. So clinical and numerical simulation studies have reported that atelectasis is comparable with nitrogen and with nitrous oxide when the entire anesthetic period is considered. For this reason, I would say it's unlikely that nitrous oxide and nitrogen have substantially different effects on intraoperative atelectasis.
I like the way you approach this. You've dismissed as unlikely some of the explanations for these disparate findings. What then might explain the discrepancies, and how should we interpret the findings?
I consider that the most likely explanation is related to fragility of results, which, by the way, applies not only to this study, but also with studies from our group in other fields. We have to keep in mind that we usually accept an effect for a given intervention at a p-value of 0.05. But a p-value of 0.05 has only 50% chance of being confirmed upon replication in other studies. And there are several examples in the medical literature where initial results were contradicted in subsequent studies. See, for example, the trials on supplemental oxygen and postoperative infection, or even the trials on intraoperative PEEP and postoperative pulmonary complications from our group, just to mention a few of them. We have also the issue of multiple testing. In both studies, atelectasis was among numerous secondary analyses that were performed. I would say because there is no other compelling explanation for the opposite results in the Enigma trials, we conducted a combined analysis that is part of our editorial. The result was that in the pool data, the incidence of atelectasis did not differ significantly given nitrous oxide versus nitrogen or oxygen.
So what do you think the take-home message is for practicing anesthesiologists about nitrous oxide?
My take-home message is that nitrous oxide most likely has little or if any effect at all on clinically meaningful atelectasis and no effect on pneumonia, which, by the way, was less evident. I would say that the decision from anesthesiologists is whether using or avoiding nitrous oxide intraoperatively should be based on other aspects. For example, risk of nausea and vomiting, presence of closed airspaces, need for sparing other agents, etc. Just to mention a few of them.
Dr. Payton, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the take-home message is for practicing anesthesiologists?
I think the bottom line is that we seem to have just further confirmed the essential safety of nitrous oxide in major surgery. As Martella was saying, we can combine the findings of the two trials. It seems that there's no reason to be concerned or alarmed of a problem with nitrous oxide in terms of pulmonary risk. Nitrous oxide has quite unique pharmacokinetics that promote rapid emergence and recovery. And the tools for safe and environmentally responsible use of nitrous oxide are now widely available on our anesthesia machines, such as automated low-flow delivery systems and modern electronic ventilators with a variety of assisted ventilation settings and whatnot. So it's never been easier to use nitrous oxide sparingly and judiciously than it is now.
Excellent. Well, tell us what comes next for you and your research group.
Our trials network has a number of large multi-center trials currently underway, focusing on a range of important post-operative outcomes. One of those is chronic post-surgical pain. I'm leading a large trial of perioperative intravenous ketamine and its effect on the risk of developing chronic post-surgical pain, which I hope we'll report in about a year's time. We're also running some other trials, two other large trials investigating the effects of intravenous lidocaine on chronic and neuropathic post-surgical pain in breast and thoracic surgery populations. So that's one big area of research that that we are very active in at the moment. We have trials commencing on in other interventions potentially affecting pulmonary complications, including Sugammadex. The VapoC trial is comparing the potential effects of inhalational and IV anesthesia and IV lidocaine on long-term cancer surgery survival, which is a trial which has now commenced here in Australasia, where there's also trials looking at interventions to reduce postoperative wound infection rates, tranexamic acid in bowel surgery. That's a TRIGS trial led by Paul Miles, and also trials in the cardiac surgery population looking at different antibiotic prophylaxis schedules, the Calypso trial. So there's plenty of work going on, so many questions to be answered and so little time and money to do it with.
Well, I want to add my sincere thanks on behalf of the entire anesthesiology community on the work that you're doing. You're asking big questions in anesthesia that are meaningful to our patients and doing it on a very large scale using a pretty robust network. And there's very little of that work going on or too little of that work going on around the world. So thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you very much.
I hope today's discussion will lead many of you that are listening to read this new article and the accompanying editorial that appear in the April 2023 issue of Anesthesiology, where you can learn more about the Enigma trials and pulmonary complications associated with nitrous oxide. Doctors Holly Endy and John Wanderer from Vanderbilt University created an infographic that's titled Yes or No to N2O that summarizes the findings of the Enigma studies and this new post hoc analysis of the Enigma 2 trial. Doctors Payton and Abreu, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.